So good morning, Eastside family. We want to ask the most amazing members of our church family to stand now. Those of you who are from 4 years old through third grade and go to junior worship. And if you're new here and you have children of that age range, just follow the exodus of people that are headed in that direction. And while they're going there, I certainly want to remind you of a very important aspect of our worship assembly, that is our offering. And there are four different ways that we make possible for you to bring your offering to the Lord. You can mail a check to our church address. You can give your offering through an automatic draft through the bank. You can go online to our website on our homepage, look for a little box that says give, and follow the simple directions. Or for those of you that are here in person, you can drop your offering off there at the basket that's at the table on the way out. Now, speaking of offering, I actually have two announcements that don't count against the sermon time that I want to share with you this morning. For those of you that have got the stopwatch running there, as a part of our vision at Eastside to connect, grow, and to serve, we have a wonderful, wonderful opportunity at this Thanksgiving season, at this Christmas season, to reach out and to touch our community. On Sunday, November 14th, and I'm thinking that's not this coming Sunday, but the next one, look on your calendar, we're going to have what we call our annual harvest offering, a thank offering. And this comes out of the Old Testament model of the Israelite people. They would do like we do. They would bring their regular tithes and offerings to the temple for the work of the Lord in the temple. But there was a time at the end of the year, or you would call it the end of the harvest season, where they were so thankful, so grateful to God, that they would bring a first fruit offering. They'd bring an offering saying, God, you have been so good to me this year that I want to express that not just in my words, but in this donation of something that I give to you. And then those donated goods would go into the community to help those who are in need. And so we have an organization that we partner with called Mercy's Gate. And so Mercy's Gate is going to receive all of our donated goods, that it's going to be food offerings that we're going to bring, or it's going to be as well a financial offering. And then Mercy's Gate, they are on the front lines, and we have a team of our members who work with Mercy's Gate. Mercy's Gate is on the front lines working with people in our community who are desperate and who are hurting, who are hungry, who are close to being homeless. And so, especially over the holiday time when they're struggling to have food for Thanksgiving, especially, there's going to be, you go to the website, you get through Care Mail, or Sarah will put the link on the bulletin as well. You find the food basket that we would ask that you would bring. You bring it on the 14th. There'll be a time in the service where you'll bring that food offering to the stage here, and we'll pray over it, and we'll send it to Mercy's Gate. There'll also be baskets on top of our regular weekly tithe for us to bring an offering of money for Mercy's Gate. And specifically, this offering was going to help some folks who are on the verge of having to move out where they live because they can't afford to stay there any longer. This is to help them stay in their homes through the holidays. Mercy's Gate does that with lots of members. And so you can make a difference. We can make a difference in that way. November 14th, be thinking about getting your food basket ready, and be thinking about the way with your finances. You can say, God, you've been so good to me. I want to in turn serve and give to someone else. And then I also want to make you aware of a class that I'm going to start teaching this coming Wednesday, right here in the auditorium on Wednesday evenings. And the name of the class, and it's going to be for a few Wednesdays to come in the future as well, is entitled The Sound of Silence. And I get that title from the passage in 1 Corinthians 14, which says that women should remain silent in the churches. I just love getting out those fun topics. So what do you do with that? What do you do with that passage that's in the Bible? And let's be honest, you look around outside of the church, this divisive thing in our culture, this issue, this struggle that we have of gender discrimination, perhaps we could call it, it's out there, but it's a struggle that becomes so challenging, so divisive in churches. It's a struggle we face in this church family. What do we do about it? How do we understand is what we're going to do. These passages in the Bible, we're going to look at not everything the Bible has to say about gender and men and women, but there's three particular passages we're really going to focus on that are the hot, sensitive ones. And we're going to look at those and say, what is God telling us here, and how does that apply to our church? And so if you want to come and be a part of that, we would love for you to be a part of that. Wednesday is at 6:30. And so, speaking of silence, that reminds me of a story. There was a married couple. I was going to use me and Karen as an example, but I thought, I better not. I'll just say there was a married couple, all right? Because we don't have this problem. And they had a hard time getting along, and whenever they would get into conflict, they would just give one another the silent treatment. They just wouldn't talk to one another for a duration of time until finally one of them just couldn't stand it any longer, and they would break down and break the silence. And so one day they were going through this really rough patch. It had lasted for over a week, and they just weren't talking to one another. Well, the husband had one day, he had this trip that he was planning going fishing, and he was going to have to get up really early at 5 a.m. And his problem was he was a real heavy sleeper, and he was afraid he was going to sleep in and not get up and miss his fishing trip. And so he needed his wife to tell his wife he needed her to wake him up at 5 in the morning because she was an early riser, had no problem with that. But the problem was he wasn't about to tell her that because he was stubborn. He wasn't going to be the one to break the silence. And so he thought, this is what I'll do. He took a little sticky note and he wrote on the sticky note, please wake me up in the morning at 5 a.m. And he put it right where he knew she would see it. And he went to bed. He woke up the next morning at 9:30 in the morning, absolutely furious that his wife failed to wake him up. And he sat up in bed, mad as he could be, and there was a note next to on his pillow that said, it's 5 a.m., wake up. Have you ever given the silent treatment? Have you ever received the silent treatment? At home? Yeah, some of you spouses are going, oh, he prepared this sermon for us. At church? Are there people here you just don't talk to? Isn't that awkward? It happens. You see them in the hallway and you do what? They turn the other way or you turn the other way and you start walking in that opposite direction. Or maybe you can't help but be in that little circle of people with them, but they just pretend and act as though you don't even exist. You're in the same room with that individual and there's no eye contact that's given. You got that going on? You got it going on where you just call and you call and you call, and will they ever pick up the phone? You send text messages, you send emails, and there's absolutely no like, is there a problem? Have they blocked me? What is going on? What is the problem? Have you ever felt that way with God? As though God is giving you the silent treatment. Did that reading that you heard on the video reading today, did you go, oh yeah, man, I get that. Listen to these words from the psalmist. Do they resonate with you? Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Like, God, where are you? How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long? You're not supposed to say these things, but these are real things. These are raw feelings, and the psalmist is expressing them. How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? And he cries out, look on me. Would you look at me? Are you even noticing? It's the silent treatment that sometimes we feel from God. And so as Luke is setting the stage for the story of Emmanuel, God with us, coming on the scene, Christ being born, as we're entering into that story, the setting of this story in the history of the Israelites is a period of what they would say the silent treatment. So let me explain. You know, I told you last week, for those of you that are kind of new to the Bible, you got two volumes. Volume 1 is the Old Testament, Volume 2 is the New Testament, and there's a period of time in between. The last book, and the very last book in the Old Testament, is the book of Malachi. In the very last book of Old Testament, Malachi, in Malachi's very last chapter, prophesied sometime around 420 BC, he writes these words that the sun, S-U-N, like the sun in the sky, the sun of righteousness, he foretold, would arise with healing in its wings. And you back up and look at the larger context of Malachi, it's clear he's speaking of this long-awaited Messiah of Jesus who would come. And those of you that are familiar with biblical history know that the Israelites longed for and they looked for the day of this prophecy to be fulfilled. But after Malachi spoke these words of prophecy, for the next 400 years, it's like there's nothing. It's like silence. There's no record of God speaking. There's no record of a prophet bringing a message from God. There's no record of an angel showing up from God and saying, God has something to say. It's like just nothing. Prayers are going up and they're like they're hitting the ceiling. No answer. Why the silence? Why the 400 years of waiting? Where is this promised son of righteousness? And it's the silent treatment. And it was more than that. It was not only a period of silence, but it was a period of darkness. And Luke, as we're going to see later on in chapter 1, that's where we're headed here in Luke. In chapter 1, in verse 78, Luke writes, the rising sun will come to us from heaven. S-U-N, the rising sun will come to us from heaven. The Jewish people clearly understood this to be the Messiah. This is very similar language to that of Malachi. The Son of Righteousness is coming. And so this tells us that prior to the rising of the sun, what's it always like? It's dark. And so prior to this coming of the Messiah, prior to the rising of the sun, it was not only a period of silence, but it was a period of darkness. And if you're familiar with the history of the Israelite people, as Luke is opening this story, you know it was an incredibly dark period of history. Back way, way, way up, and you have the Assyrians who invaded the northern kingdom. They destroyed the northern kingdom, took captives away, and the northern kingdom from that period further ceased to exist. And then we follow the story of the Babylonian Empire. Say, we'll take care of the south. They moved into the southern kingdom, destroyed the southern kingdom, and for 70 years carried the people away into a period of darkness and captivity. And followed by that, there was a period of the rule and the oppression of the Medo-Persian Empire over the Jewish people. And then that was followed by years of rule and cruel oppression under the empire of the Greeks, who, for example, under a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes, he brutally butchered many Jews. He came into the temple, the holy of holies, the most holy place. He desecrated those sacred places. He sacrificed a pig on the altar and he brought idols into the land. And then when they were done, that was followed by the Jewish people now being subjected, as Luke opens his gospel, to the rule of the Roman Empire. And they placed Herod in place over the local people there in Judea, as we read in Luke in verse 5. So this whole time, the Jewish people waiting on God to do something. You ever been there? Crying out for this to end, to regain their place, to regain their kingdom, to regain their promised king. But silence for 400 years. And they're asking, I thought Malachi promised the Son of Righteousness would come. And the Son of Righteousness, Malachi, also prophesied that he's going to trample down and defeat our enemies where they're still in place. And so Israel sunk into a period of despair and depression and their own form of rebellion and religious apostasy, waiting and wondering, when will God ever do something about this just as he promised? And it reminds you, doesn't it? It does me, of the story way further back in the Old Testament of the Israelites that were in Egypt, enslaved for 400 years, crying out, "Free us." And you've got to think that in that 400-year time, there was somebody that was born, and this child grew up hearing their parents pray for deliverance. And then that child, as an adult, for the rest of that child's life, prayed for deliverance, and in that 400-year period of time, died never seeing it. What about that? The silent treatment. And so this is the setting as Luke opens his gospel. A period of silence from God. And it's dark. And the people are waiting. Waiting for the promised deliverance and for the promised Messiah, as Isaiah identified him as Emmanuel. Oh, come. Oh, come, Emmanuel, was the cry of their heavy hearts. And that's a popular Christmas song. But if you look at the words, it's a song of crying out to God in despair, in darkness, in longing. Listen to these words. Oh, come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appear. God, come and set us free. O come, thou rod of Jesse, free thine own from Satan's tyranny. O come, thou dayspring from on high, that rising sun. O come, thou dayspring from on high, and cheer us. Cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night. Some of us are there now. And so into this time of darkness and silence and uncertainty, Luke writes this gospel. In his prologue, he mentions to give certainty to the people. Now, there was another prophecy that Malachi, as he's closing in chapter 4 with, another prophecy that accompanied the prophecy of the coming of this Messiah. He prophesies, now, before this Lord, this Messiah, this deliverer comes, you'll know that he's coming, because prior to him, there will be this forerunner, he calls it, who will herald and prepare the people for the coming of the Messiah. And so be looking for that, Malachi says. And so they look for 400 years. And so Luke builds a segue, a bridge from Malachi to Luke 1. And he opens his gospel with that story of this forerunner. Not really the forerunner at first, but with his parents, Zechariah and Elizabeth. They're our main characters today, to you kids who are taking notes. They're actually some that are, that's why I mentioned that. And here's what's fascinating. This story of Zechariah and Elizabeth is a snapshot of the larger story of Israel. For this is a couple on an individual basis who were experiencing what Israel was facing on a national basis. They were going through the silent treatment. Let's enter the story. Luke chapter 1 and verse 5. In the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah, who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron. Let's stop there for a minute, and just it's worth noting. Elizabeth is a beautiful Hebrew name that is translated, literally you would understand it to mean God's oath. Promise from God, God's oath. Zechariah is also a Hebrew name that means God remembers. And so you put that together, Zechariah and Elizabeth, God remembers his oath. And that's incredibly ironic given their story and given the story of Israel at this period of their history, because it sure didn't feel like God had remembered any promises. They were, as Luke tells us, they were a people from a good family. They had a lot going for them. They were from a very prestigious priestly lineage. And then their character, they were of impeccable character. As Luke describes in verse 6, he says, both of them were righteous in the sight of God. I wonder what I am in the sight of God. Both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly. Luke tells us of this couple, but there was one monster blemish on this beautiful couple. Verse 7, but they were childless because Elizabeth was not able to conceive, and they were both very old. And if you know the history of the first century time, to be childless in their day, as Elizabeth is going to mention later, it was a stigma. It was a social disgrace. And now at their age, it's too late. And so you just got to put yourselves in their shoes, and you just wonder, how many prayers do you suppose they prayed? How often did they ask God for a child, only to get nothing? Silence. Did they ever wonder if God cared? Would you have? Did they ever question his love? I might have. Did they ever just become angry with God? Have you? And here's the crazy part. We're getting ready to go into the next story with Mary. And here's this virgin teenager who gets pregnant with absolutely no effort. It's so unfair. Why her? What about me? You ever felt that way? But then, after years of silence and discouragement and longing, God broke the silence for Zechariah and Elizabeth, but also for Israel. Verse 8, once when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as priest before God, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And when the time for the burning of incense came, all the assembled worshipers, you got to visualize this, they were praying outside. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and gripped with fear, but the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, your prayer has been heard." And so we have to ask, well, what prayer is he talking about? Could it have been, yes, the prayer for a child. But as a faithful Israelite, you can imagine Zechariah had been praying for the coming of the Messiah. Look at the larger context here of chapter 1, and I'm inclined to believe your prayer has been heard was both of those prayers. God had been listening. He had been listening. Verse 13. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and You're to call him John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He is never to take wine or other fermented drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before he is born. He will bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God, and he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn, this is beautiful, to turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. And if you remember Malachi in chapter 4, he's pulling that from Malachi. Those are Malachi's words of prophecy given some 400 years prior. They're going to have a boy. They're going to have a boy. His name's going to be John. But wait a minute. Zechariah asked the angel, verse 18, how can I be sure of this? I'm an old man, and my wife is well along in years. Now, no offense, Don and Norma, but if God said to you, you're going to conceive and give birth to a child, you would do what I'm doing right now. You'd laugh and say, no way. It's okay for Don to say, I don't get it. How is that going to happen? Verse 19, the angel said to him, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and tell you this good news. The angel's point is, look, you're questioning God? Well, yeah. Yeah, actually, I am. Now, keep in mind this. I think this is significant to note. If the angel in this moment was standing in the presence of God, and if Zechariah was standing in the presence of the angel, that tells me that in this time of prayer, prayers that were symbolized by these incense that he was burning in the holy place, that means in this time of prayer, he was standing in the presence of God. God was there. He had always been there, watching and listening. I think I need that reminder because it's possible for me to go through the ritual of prayer and it be nothing more than a ritual, forgetting that you stand in the presence of God. So the angel told Zechariah in verse 20, and now you will be silent and not able to speak until this day happens, because you did not believe my words, which will come true at their appointed time. So take that phrase, their appointed time, put it over here, and we're going to bring it back in a minute. I just think it's not really a main point. You can work this out in your life groups. Isn't it interesting that for 400 years there's silence for God and from God, and now he speaks, and now there's going to be 9 months of silence for Zechariah. Verse 21, meanwhile the people were waiting for Zechariah and wondering why he had stayed so long in the temple. When he came out, he could not speak to them. They realized he had seen a vision in the temple, for he kept making signs to them. But his wife, they could not make signs to him, but remained unable to speak. Excuse me, verse 23. When this time of service was completed, he returned home. You know, Elizabeth must have been curious to tell me everything that happened. Not a word. After this, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant. Norma's pregnant! And for 5 months remained in seclusion. Why in seclusion? Because if Norma said, I'm pregnant, everybody would go, you're crazy, Norma, until she starts showing. 5 months later. Can you imagine? This is a miracle. I love her words. Verse 25, the Lord has done this for me, she said. In these days he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace among the people. And so with this, Kevin's been telling crazy stories, Bible stories to the teenagers on Wednesday nights. Kevin, this is a crazy story. With this unbelievable story, Luke is now setting the story of Christ Emmanuel coming into this world. And there is so much here that I had to leave out. So it's for you and your life groups to unpack the details of this story. I'm going to give you three things that I think are significant from this story. I first of all see a lesson about God. In the darkness, I want you to hear this. Some of you need to hear this. In the darkness, in the dark night of the soul, when you can't see him, he is there. In the deafening silence, with tears as you cry out to him, he's listening and he's answering in his appointed, I'm bringing that back over, remember I put it over here, in his appointed time, not yours. I've learned over the years that he doesn't always give me what I want, when I want. And looking back on those times, that's a good thing. It's a lesson about God. It's a lesson for us. What do you do? What do you do in this time of the silent treatment? One word. Wait. Wait. Those were the words of the prophet Isaiah to God's people in Isaiah 40. Very similar to Malachi's time frame in Isaiah 40, 31. To these people of Israel who were getting ready to go into 70 years of captivity. 70 years of darkness. And that was going to be followed by many more years of pain and oppression. And just like with Malachi, God through Isaiah said, yes, but one day will come this forerunner who will clear the path for the Messiah. And then the Messiah will come. But for now, for this moment, you must wait. You know the song, some of you do, upon the Lord. You could translate that. You must trust in the Lord. You must hope in the Lord. And so for Zechariah and Elizabeth, in spite of the fact that things weren't going the way they wanted, when they wanted, they trusted. They hoped. They waited on the Lord with a waiting marked by, you saw it, their faithful obedience. Didn't give up on God. And prayer. And why does God do that to us? Why the waiting? These are not my words. I found them from someone else. I failed in my journal to write their name down. Here it is. What God does in us, listen to this carefully. What God does in us while we are waiting is sometimes more important than what we're waiting for. I'm not saying what we're waiting for isn't important. What God does in us while we are waiting is sometimes more important than what we're waiting for. So many times we think of the waiting as just the time you've got to endure until you get from God what you want, when actually it's the waiting period where God is doing his incredible transformative work in our lives. And that demands faith. And that's hard. Trusting when you don't know, you don't understand, you don't see it, and you don't even like it. But I've often thought that perhaps if we always got what we always wanted, when we wanted it, would we be so inclined to even walk with God? Because would we even feel like we need him? But it's there in the waiting that it pulls us to our knees in prayer where God wants us, where God can do his greatest work in our lives. There's a lesson for us. There's a lesson about God here, and as this story is setting the stage for Jesus, there's an incredibly relevant lesson about Jesus. Who is this one who was to come who came to the people years ago and now is coming into our lives. Oh, there's so much to say here. I would summarize it in these ways. He is the fulfillment of God's promise to his people. God had not forgotten. He has not forgotten you. He is, as Zechariah and Liz's name, sometimes an abbreviation, I don't put Elizabeth, I put Liz, my bad. He is, let me say it correctly, I've got Zech and Liz here about 100 times in my notes. Let me say it correctly. He is, as Zechariah and Elizabeth's names convey, the God who remembered his oath. Who is this Messiah? He is the voice of God who spoke into our deafening silence. He is the one who is preceded by others, by Zechariah, by Elizabeth, and then it would be by John to prepare the hearts and lives of people for the coming of Christ. And so there is a calling here for us to be those forerunners as we are entering into the season of Advent, to be his heralds of proclaiming and preparing and helping people who don't know Christ to invite them to know him. He is, as Malachi prophesied, the sun, S-U-N, of righteousness that rises with healing in his wings. He is, as Luke writes, the rising sun that comes to us from heaven. He brings light into our darkness. He brings light into our nation, into our lives, and brings light out of our longing, out of our waiting, out of our sin, out of our strife, out of our division. He brings light into a pandemic. He brings light into political strife, into our racial tension, into our family conflicts, into our marital conflicts, into our financial conflicts. He brings light into our loneliness, in our depression, into our mourning, in our uncertainty. And so this popular Christmas song tells us as well, oh come, Emmanuel. This song describes him as the desire of nations. The desire of the nation of Israel. The desire of the nation of America. The desire of the nations of the world. Listen to these words that were actually written in Latin 1,200 years ago, translated in English, and they are so incredibly applicable as a longing in our hearts today for Christ to come. O come, desire of nations, bind all peoples in one heart and mind. Bid envy, strife, and quarrels cease. Fill the whole world with heaven's peace. 1,200 years later, it's still the prayer of our longing that is so relevant and needed. Let's pray. Father, in this moment of silence, and in this moment that for some of us is so dark and uncertain, we come before you and we lift up to you this prayer of longing for your coming again and again into our lives, into our nation, into our world. Who is this promised Messiah to come? He is the God who in this moment of our silence and our darkness is very present, who hears and who cares and who answers as we cry out to him. So what is the longing of your heart for your life, for your family, for your nation? We want to bring this longing before God in prayer, and I want to encourage you to go to one another. Let's get out of our chairs, and if you need a shepherd to come pray with you, our shepherds are available. Let's bring before God our hearts as we enter into this time of prayer.